This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas. It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, chewing the fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio CALS, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Welcome, everyone, to our latest installment of Primary Sources, a service of the Central Arkansas Library System. I am Matt DeCampbell. Our guest this time is Mark Crist, who is the Community Outreach Director for the Department of Arkansas Heritage, which more specifically for this podcast means that he is doing a lot of the work on the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commission. Am I saying that correct?
Centennial Commemoration Committee.
Commemoration Committee.
Yeah.
Got to get a few more C's in there. We like some good alliteration. Well, welcome to the show, first of all, Mark.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The Great War is kind of a gap in a lot of people's history and education.
Right. Yeah. And the United States was involved in the war for a relatively short time compared to the European countries. But Arkansas was deeply affected by the war. You know, on the front end, we had almost 72,000 soldiers who served during the during 1917, 1918, 1919. 2,183 of them died, the majority of disease, but a significant number of combat casualties as well. And close to 2,000 were wounded or otherwise injured during the course of the war.
And in the buildup to the U.S. involvement, because as you said, it was, what, 3.5 years or so that the war went on before the U.S. got involved, you see, or at least I saw when I was going back reading through it, a lot of the same things you would later see in World War II or in the Cold War, where you had a lot of factions forming and a lot of suspicion rising and some paranoia.
Right.
Can you talk about some of that?
Right. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of anti-German sentiment as we became involved in the war, and that was significant in Arkansas because we had a sizable German population, not just in Little Rock but around the state. There was an incident in early 1917. Where they raided the Subiaco Abbey.
I was going to bring that up. Fascinated me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were German monks at Subiaco, and the local authorities thought that they were using, they had a radio transmitter for whatever reason. They thought they were using it to contact the Kaiser. So they sent in the sheriff to disable the radio, and the guy had never seen a set like that. So he said, if I smash it up with my axe, will that disable it? Which, of course, it did.
Yeah.
And then there were like things like German-American banks at the start of the war. A lot of those places changed their names. They became the American National Bank and things like that. The editor of one of the German newspapers in Little Rock, the Arkansas Staatszeitung, was actually imprisoned. So it was a difficult time, and for the German American citizens, and they a lot of them went out of their way to prove their loyalty, but there was, as you mentioned, a lot of opposition to the war. Significantly, the Russellites, who were it's a group that's now known as the Jehovah's Witnesses, but they didn't believe in fighting, so. And strangely enough, some of them got into armed conflicts with federal agents and law enforcement officers who came to enforce the draft. So there were six or seven what are now called draft wars during the mostly in 1918, Claiborne County, Newton County, you know, the mountainous areas tended to breed that kind of opposition.
And the draft in World War I feels a little different than how it operated. It seemed to be more of a, and I don't mean this in a, you know, creepy way, but it was kind of a creeping draft, right? It wasn't like all at once, or was there one declaration and it was on?
Well, there was one day, okay. And I'm trying to recall. I think it was in June of 1917, or it might have been a little earlier, but there was one day that everyone between the age of, I think it was 18 and 35, had to go in and register. And there was a lot of play about that in the Arkansas Gazette and the Arkansas Democrat, you know, that, you know, different cities, you know, different counties, how many people they brought out and things like that. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a bit of a scandal in Little Rock, where the son of the mayor was arrested and accused of dodging the draft. But, you know, the mayor brought out his birth certificate, and it showed that he was born, you know, like 6 weeks too early to be up for the draft.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was, you know, political shenanigans.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
And I have to think, I mean, you were talking about some of the mountainous regions of the state a century ago. Getting word about the draft out probably still didn't reach everyone by the registration date.
Right. Yeah. A lot of folks way back in the woods. But then, you know, a lot of those same people, you know, their ancestors, you know, during the Civil War, were the guys who, you know, didn't really want to fight for either side too. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was really in a lot of ways a family tradition to
stay out of it.
It's not their fight. So that you know, some of that attitude, I think, bled over into the First World War.
And there was also, I mean, you talk about political shenanigans. Well, not even on a greater, I think, governing level. You had two U.S. senators in Arkansas that had very vastly different approaches to the war.
Incredibly different. Senator Robinson, Joe T. Robinson, was a hawk, and Senator Robert Kirby was not as supportive of the war. Robinson went so far as to one of the lead opponents to the war in the Senate was Robert La Follette of Wisconsin. And at one point in a floor speech, Robinson got up and just insulted La Follette, to where, you know, the other senators were holding back the Wisconsin senator and Robinson saying, "Hey, I'll meet you outside." You know, so just very acrimonious.
And there was another senator, wasn't there, who he challenged that they should both resign, and the voters would. Does that not ring any bell?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, I thought I saw a story about a senator from Missouri who was very much on the other side. You know, they both said they had the best interests of the country, and so
yeah.
Robinson says, "Well, let's both step down and see what the voters say."
I could certainly see Joe T. Robinson doing that,
and he was like that on a lot of issues. He was obviously very hawkish, but he was not a wallflower in the U.S. Senate.
No, he was a big man. He had a big voice, and he used it with great effect. And that continued on beyond World War I into his support of FDR and the New Deal during the Depression leading up to the Second World War.
And that's another thing too, not the Depression per se, but you had a lot of other things going on during World War I. You had the big flu pandemic.
Right.
You had something. Was there a panic in financial panic around?
I'm not familiar with that.
I'm trying to remember. But, I mean, you had a international, worldwide flu pandemic going on.
Yes.
Including in Arkansas.
And really that was, I mean, I think millions and millions of people died from what they now call the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. And that affected, you know, that hit Arkansas very hard too.
More than the war. I mean, worldwide.
Yeah. And you know, of those 2,000, you know, or so soldiers who died, you know, a lot of them were killed by the flu. And it was such a virulent disease, you know, that these healthy young men would wake up in the morning, you know, and then get the sniffles. And by the time the sun went down, they were dead. So as, you know, we had a major training facility at Camp Pike, what is now Camp Robinson in North Little Rock. So as succeeding drafts of soldiers were brought in, they were quarantined for several weeks to make sure, you know, that they didn't have the flu and bring it into the rest of the soldiers there.
And Camp Pike was established for World War I, correct?
For World War I, yes. Yeah. Initially, there was some training done at Fort Roots, mm-hmm. and it just wasn't big enough to fulfill the needs of the Army. So there was a big drive. I mean, lots of places all over the South were wanting to have this base. You know, it's kind of like, you know, now we're seeing, you know, people vying to be the second Amazon headquarters.
Right.
This was a similar thing back in the day. And, you know, it was the Little Rock Chamber of Commerce made a great offer they couldn't refuse. And that brought the facility here with all the resultant jobs and contracts and things like that.
Which, of course, interestingly enough, was not established within Little Rock. I mean, it was
right.
north of North Little Rock.
North of North Little Rock, right.
But, which Argenta at the time, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but everybody benefited from having it here, and the bulk of the businesses would have been in Little Rock anyways. So, you know, they benefited greatly from it.
And as you had the draft and you had all of these young men going off to war, we hear a lot about the stories and, of course, Rosie the Riveters up at Crystal Bridges, but all these things about the women entering the workforce. But this happened in World War I as well.
Right. Yes, there was quite a bit of that. It was the first appearance of the Red Cross in Arkansas. And there was a really an industrial boom as well, a mining boom because, you know, they needed zinc for weapons. The town of Zinc, the ghost town of Zinc up on the Buffalo River is
right.
a reminder of that. Aluminum was needed, so the bauxite mines in Saline County were booming. I've heard that 10 million canteens were made from Arkansas aluminum because of that. Wood for gun stocks was taken from the Delta counties. And here in Little Rock, it's kind of interesting. Near what's now the airport, there was a picric acid plant built that, it was huge. Picric acid made a very powerful explosive. And this was another one of those contracts that we really wanted to get.
Sure.
And they ended up getting it. And it was such a big plant that that they didn't have sufficient manpower in Little Rock to handle it. So they drafted, you know, labor drafted people, barbers, bellhops, you know, people who didn't have essential war kind of jobs were sent to work in the plant. That still didn't work. So they brought people from out in the state, and they still didn't have enough people. So they brought several hundred Puerto Rican workers to work in the plants. And those poor guys got here, and the climate was bad, the flu was bad, and hundreds of them died. There's a memorial cenotaph to those Puerto Rican Picron workers in Cavalry Cemetery in Little Rock, which is kind of an interesting side story.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And we didn't even build up to the women in the workforce yet.
Right.
But obviously, as they're pulling in men from other industries and other parts of the state, and in some cases, you know, a territory, you needed someone to fill those positions.
Right. Yeah. And it really, the World War I was happening at the same time as the drive toward suffrage for women.
Yes.
So the suffragists were a lot of them were highly supportive of the war because it did help to empower women and bring them into more visible roles as workers and things like that. And I think you could make a very good case that it was a key element toward the eventual passage of the amendment that gave women the right to vote.
Wow. And I'm just jumping all over the place because you say something that reminds me of something else. Mm-hmm. But when President Wilson, his daughter came to Northeast Arkansas and ended up like doing pretty much a tour of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It was part, I think, of a national tour that she was
for war bonds and
just, you know, building up support for the war and things like that. So, yeah, I know she was in Little Rock. I know she was in Jonesboro.
I think she started in Osceola even and just kind of worked mm-hmm. her way. And it was she was a singer, I believe, or
she was
sort
a
of
singer. She would come and sing. She had I'm trying to recall the exact quote, but the Gazette said she had a, you know, very high mellifluous voice And I know that they had a stopover in Louisville down in South Arkansas, and they basically shut the town down and feted Miss Wilson.
Well, for Lafayette County, I mean, even then, that's going to be a big deal. So
very big deal.
You're going to get the most out of that out of you can. Yep. I remember now that I mentioned Wilson, that is the argument that Senator Robinson was in was over the League of Nations. With the senator from Missouri.
Okay. And,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Because he was very supportive of President Wilson's move.
Right.
And others in the Senate.
Yeah, that's a little farther than I am in the war, right?
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm looking in the future. This is, we'll have to come back in a year and a half and do that toward the armistice. So when the American involvement happened, and you talk about all of these troops leaving Arkansas, was it a big bulk at once, or was it spread out over months and weeks? And
well, the National Guard was federalized, so that was one of the first things. Those troops went over, you know, pretty much as a unit. But then it was just that there was constant training, I think, throughout the war of soldiers at Camp Pike, and as a draft would get its training, they would be sent over and fed into, you know, other units. A lot of them went in as replacements for casualties. So, you know, not all of the guys who trained here, you know, fought as a unit once they got to Europe.
And just based on the records we have, what was it like for them? Because, you know, this is the first war of this scale where you are crossing an ocean to go,
right.
You know, you're truly in an unknown world as opposed to the Civil War, where you're in some very unknown places, but it's still
America.
Yeah. But what was it like for them?
Well, you know, for a lot of these folks, it's the first time they've been out of Arkansas or whatever their home state was. You know, so they would have the long boat ride and the tension over the possibility of being torpedoed.
Right.
And we did lose some Arkansas men in vessels that were sunk by German submarines. Once they got there, they would be placed into the trenches. So, you know, we had, in fact, in November of 1918, the first action with American soldiers took place. Germans raided an American salient and killed several guys, wounded several, one of whom was an Arkansan. So, you know, they had they had life in the trenches, you know, the horror of gas attacks, you know, disease. It was all wars are horrible.
Of course.
This one had its own special horrors that
I think it was just the exponential ramping from what we had known before to this technological, I guess, leap for the worse in a lot of ways.
Yes, and as with the Civil War, a lot of the tactics of did not advance with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, I'm sure, unnecessary casualties during World War I.
And you have to think that a lot of these soldiers, of course, had family members that they grew up with memories of the Civil War, and a lot of the things they did or didn't talk about with that in their banging around in their heads while they're also crossing
right.
the ocean.
Yeah, one of the best pictures that I've seen that has kind of come up since the commemoration started came from Melissa Nesbitt, who's down at the South Arkansas Regional Archives in Hempstead County. And she had a picture of her grandfather and her granduncle in their doughboy suits, and they're standing on either side of their father, who was a Confederate veteran, you know, and seeing his boys off to fight for the United States. So, you know, the war did end a lot of those kind of divisions, and, you know, people became more united that might have been harboring grudges from the earlier fight.
Yeah. So, and explain to our listeners and to me a bit about the Doughboys and then your personal connection as well.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, the overwhelming majority of the American soldiers who fought were draftees. We had a very small standing army at the start of the war. So there was just a massive boom to train these guys and get them over there. And General Pershing at the same time was trying to, you know, fighting to make sure that they wouldn't just get tossed into German, I mean, not German, but British and French units that, you know, had already suffered, you know, debilitating casualties.
Right.
He wanted them to remain under American command as American units, and he did succeed in that. But as I said, most of them were draftees, and one of those draftees was my grandfather, Gregory Bone.
And where did the term come from?
You know, I don't know what the origin of that is, and I should, but I'm not sure exactly what the where that came from.
Well, we're giving you plenty of material to add to the future presentations
That's right.
you do
That's right.
as the war goes. Maybe it's because they were the raw dough that we had to mold into soldiers.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be.
And when you say the doughboy outfits, then you just mean their military uniforms.
Right. Okay. Well, doughboy outfits, I mean more like units, companies,
platoons,
things like that.
So then what was, what have you heard through the generations in your family about your grandpa and that experience?
Well, it's, he rarely, if ever, spoke about it, and he was a very, very gentle man. I was never able to picture him in a foxhole. And he was gassed. He swallowed some gas and, it ended up killing him, 30 years after the war. Mm-hmm. But like many soldiers from all wars, he went over, he did his bit, he got back, he got home, got married, had a passel of kids, and lived a good life, but never wanted to share what happened to him over there.
And that's another piece that I think comes with the advance in technology and tactics and everything, is that also this was, as you put it with your grandpa, probably the first war in American history where a lot of people suffered the effects for years and decades. Mm-hmm. And not just the physical effects. Obviously, everyone had great, mental effect from it. But the fact that you could contract something that was going to kill you, but not like gout or something from the Civil War, this is something that could take years and years or decades.
Right, right. And a lot of those gas victims wouldn't live to long lives. Well, the gentleman who was injured in that first attack in mm-hmm. November of 1918, he just lived a few years after the war. He wasn't gassed, but his injuries were bad enough that he never really recovered from it. And two, a lot of the injuries that they suffered were just horrific. The medicine had improved to where they could keep these guys alive, but they would be missing parts of their face, limbs, things.
It was
like
not
that.
A pleasant extension of
absolutely
life.
Not.
Yeah. Talk to me a little more about the Red Cross and their kind of, coming out during the First World War and kind of becoming the large organization that they are today.
Right, right. Well, initially they were doing things like, there'd be Red Cross stations set up at train depots to, have stuff for the boys as the troop trains came through. They would prepare bandages, things like that, just supply things for the for the war effort. But it was they also went on to the other side of the ocean. They were there as nurses and help, and so it was really the formative years for what became what I think is still today the probably the primary private aid service certainly in the country.
And they seemed to become a very strong voice very quickly when it came to mustering support for the war effort and to kind of help organize things on the home front.
Right. Yeah. If you read the newspaper accounts of the era, just about every day in the newspaper, there's going to be some kind of a Red Cross drive going on. Calling for people to volunteer. And going back to women on the home front, the women of Arkansas were organized, into, county groups and things like that.
Auxiliaries.
And they would, initially, they said, we need these things knitted. So, there were hundreds, if not thousands of women knitting socks and sweaters, things like that, in prep for the winter. Elizabeth Hill, who's done a lot of research on that subject, mentions one doughboy who wrote home and said, we appreciate getting all this stuff, but please don't send us any more socks.
We've got all we need.
Yeah, all we need. Yeah.
Well, and from previous war experiences, that was often one of the greatest needs was
right.
quality footwear. So
yeah, footwear. Yeah, and just we weren't really ready for the war, but these sweaters and things like that first cold winter that they were over there, it really was a boon for the soldiers.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk a bit about, going back to both of our shared past, the journalism mm-hmm. and the fact that, and obviously you've read a lot of the archives from the Gazette mm-hmm. from back then, and it seemed like that, of course, it was a great conduit for learning what was going on a world away, but there were also a lot of, again, I don't want to lean too heavily on the word shenanigans, but you had a lot of things that kind of got reported and blown out of proportion and led to some things on the home front.
Right, right. I don't have really a for instance.
Maybe not the last part, but just in general. I mean, talk about what that did to amplify the, I guess, the impact of journalism in Arkansas.
Well, the newspaper, at least the Gazette, was very supportive of the war. And if you weren't supportive of the war, you would not have a sympathetic ear in that newspaper. The editor of the Stadt Zeitung, for instance, you know, I mean, they openly mocked him. You know, they had an article where they were talking about his accent and things like that.
And this isn't even editorials.
This is news copy.
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of shaming of people who didn't sign up for the draft and things like that.
And how did they have to expand their scope, I mean, the newspaper, to get, or were they working a lot of wire services to get information from the front?
I think there was a lot of wire copy. I'm sure we had correspondence over there. But really, one of the coolest things from journalism in back in the day is, you know, the soldiers would write home to the newspaper, and you would have these first-person accounts that were published. You know, the soldiers' letters would be published in the newspaper, which is something that had also happened during the Civil War. One great project that's going on right now, in fact, Mike Polston, who works here in Cal's at the Butler Center, is the honcho on this. But he has a project where people are transcribing those, you know, letters sent home to their county newspapers, and, you know, they're transcribing them, and he's putting those online through the American History Museum in Cabot.
Again, the website is www1,
right.
www1.arkansas.
And it's www1arkansas.com.
Okay, so all one word, www1arkansas.com.
Right. Yeah. And you can use a numeral or an I, and both
will
work.
You've got both domains.
Work. Yes.
Great. If people want more information beyond that, too, because, of course, DAH, I mean, Heritage works in so many historical areas in the state, including preservation.
Right.
You know, what are some recent highlights for them to be checking out for that as well, lest you promote the whole department while you're here?
One of the things we have coming up is the second year of the Arkansas Food Awards. I can't remember the exact name of
the Food Hall of Fame. Yeah.
Food Hall of Fame. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Had a blank moment there. But yes, that the second year of that, and it's it was very popular in its first year.
It was. I was there. Yeah.
We anticipate a lot of more nominations this year. And that's a really cool way to, first honor, you know, some of the great restaurants we have around the state. One of the best aspects of my job is I get to travel a lot, and there are some fabulous restaurants in Arkansas. So that's a good way to recognize those. And of course, our museums all have ongoing great exhibits. We have the Historic Arkansas Museum, Mosaic Templars Cultural Center, and Old State House Museum in Little Rock. The Old State House, by the way, survives because it became the World War I Memorial Building, the War Memorial Building after the war. Some folks were wanting to tear it down, and a coalition of women's groups got together and said, we need to preserve this building and save it as an honor to the Doughboys. So that's a direct connection to the war. We also have the Delta Cultural Center in Helena, and they're doing a lot of World War I programming during the centennial commemoration.
Great. And the general website for the department or for preservation, whichever one is easier?
ArkansasPreservation.com is the one for my agency. And I believe it's ArkansasHeritage.com is the website. And if you go to the department website, that'll get you to all of the other eight divisions within the department.
Great. Well, thank you for being here, Mark. Mark Crist with the World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee.
Thank you. That's it.
Whew. All right. I survived that test. Thanks for being here. Of course, you can always find more of our podcasts at cals.org, along with a lot of other information, including some of what we've talked about working on with the Butler Center work with archiving these stories of the soldiers back through World War I. And always just walk into your local library and you will find a lot of great information on this. And if you're lucky, you'll end up down some rabbit holes and learn about some things you never even thought you'd want to know about. And thank you for tuning into this episode. We will see you the next time around and have yourself a great day.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Jobe and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell Hoskin and David Strickland.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.